Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody to Here District. Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson. We are the only father and son duo combination to win a national championship in college basketball at the same school, UCLA. And speaking of UCLA, our next guest has a connection to UCLA. His son, the very talented TJ Cummings, was a Bruin and a roommate who had a great time in college with my son Josiah. And Chris hung out with him too. But Terry Cummings, man, we appreciate you being here on Here District, man.
TC,
welcome.
TC.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah. So the other thing is that you and I share some history.
Right.
September 29th, 1984, Chris, I'm chilling at my non-practical, big, gigantic house in River Hills. 5-6 bedrooms, TC all over the place, big spread, ranch style. And I get the call that I've been traded to the Los Angeles Clippers. The Clippers had just moved from San Diego to Los Angeles. And the guy that was involved in that trade, along with Junior Bridgman, Harvey Catchings, was Terry Cummings, goes from the Clippers to Milwaukee. And I don't know about you, man, but, I was happy initially because I was going from Milwaukee winners to L.A. and the Clippers and all that, man. But I didn't know about Donald Sterling and just kind of the
it was sitting there waiting on you.
And so you're from Chicago, you know,
right,
minutes away. So you were kind of coming home. But you talked about having a premonition, a dream or something that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, I probably knew before the owners did because I'd had a dream that I had been traded and I was playing for a team in a green uniform. And I knew I didn't want to play for Boston. For my own reasonings. And so I went to the owner and Sterling was sitting at his desk and he asked me how I was doing and what he could do for me. And I told him, I said, you can trade me. And he said, well, I can't trade you because you're the franchise player. And I said, no, you could trade me. And I said, and when you do, trade me to Milwaukee. And so that's really how it happened. I still wound up at the end of my second year in San Diego with the Clippers. I still wound up in that third year in camp, but I only went to one day of camp, I think, if I went at all. And because that morning, about 4 or 5 in the morning, I got a call that I had been traded.
I had been praying because, you know, I only lost 6 games in college. Mm. We lost 6 games my first week and a half with the Clippers.
Yeah.
And I was having an emotional issue with it for 2 years.
Wow.
And I'd just been praying about it, and I had a dream, and I saw myself playing with a team, and I knew what the team was. It was a team in green. I knew I didn't want to play for Boston, so I knew Milwaukee close to home, and we had some kind of ties because we played Marquette when I was at DePaul, so you play at the Mecca for the big game. So, and it just turns out I was in there in my hotel room. I had moved with the team to LA, but I didn't move my family.
Right.
When they went up that year, it would have been my third year with them. After the first practice, about 3 or 4 in the morning, I got a call and they told me I'd been traded. I was jumping up and down on the bed. So one day they called the police on me. But just so you know, I had no knowledge that we were being traded for each other until the trade took place.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So it was you and Craig Hodges and Ricky Pierce.
Going
to the Bucks. The double deuces.
The Bucks got Ricky Pierce and Terry Cummings.
And Hodges. A young Craig Hodges. Yeah.
And Ricky was just kind of coming into his own. He had 120 plus points a game with the Bucks, you know, but he was just kind of coming into his own.
So
Junior and me and Harvey Catchings went out to LA with all that Donald Sterling foolishness. And I don't know where you guys were holding training camp, TC, but we were out at Pomona, staying at an Econo Lodge.
I got stories, man. We went to Houston one year with them, and they put us up in this, they had the dinettes and stuff, you know, like those hotels that extended stay like.
They had a kitchen
and stuff. Man, I went to sleep up in that joint and rolled over in the morning. Looked like, because it looked like the walls, something was moving on the walls. All the walls were full of roaches.
Wow.
And I had thought to myself, I said, now I was raised around these critters. I do not want this anymore. But they were different. But when you first came in the league, were you still carrying your own stuff, washing your own uniform after games and stuff like that?
No, we weren't. I mean, by that time, the trainer, Tony Spino, who was in Milwaukee at that point, Jeff Snedeker took his place a couple of years later. But he would take care of all that. I mean, the equipment guy, but you guys were watching.
Damn, Doc. Look, they gave us little packets of wool light. I ain't lying. That's right. And however you gonna smell is based upon how you make this stuff spread out over time. So you had to wash your jersey and your shorts, hang them in the bathroom, and pray to God they dry by the next morning.
Wow,
you know?
That's crazy.
And I think a lot of teams are still doing that, but for some reason, when Tony Spino kind of took it upon himself to make sure, you know, our stuff was washed and ready for that next day. But look, man. You first came on my consciousness. What year was that you guys came out to UCLA?
When I was at DePaul?
Yeah. Was that your freshman year?
Yeah.
You and Teddy Grubbs? Chris, you don't know this name. Teddy Grubbs.
He's a bad boy.
Might have been the best player on that. Was Mark Aguirre on that team? I think Mark Aguirre was on that. I think Mark may have been a year ahead.
Yeah, we played together for 2 years.
Yeah, so Mark Aguirre, Chris, Terry Cummings, but Teddy Grubbs was a 6'8".
Teddy Grubbs.
Smooth. Teddy Grubbs. I mean, I thought he was like the kid. And Terry was good. Terry was great.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I was in the background. They told me, though, Marcus, they made it really clear to me, because I had been playing against the pro types since I was 16.
Okay.
But when I came to DePaul, they didn't know I could really play.
Yeah.
But then when I got into the practices, the coaches pulled me aside one day and told me, "Hey, we don't care how good you are. This is Mark's team, and you got to wait till Mark leaves."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, fine, as long as you know, because back then that wasn't unusual.
Right.
You know, you couldn't step over somebody who had been there before you.
Yeah.
And so it was cool. But I'm gonna tell you something. Teddy was my roommate freshman year. And for a guy his size, he might have been one of the first guys at his height that probably had a 40-plus vertical.
Yeah.
And he was long.
Chris.
And the smoothest jump shot.
Yeah.
What happened with him?
Well, he went back to five-star going into his senior year. I was doing some research on him and Howard Garfinkel fell in love with him, thought he was one of the greatest forwards he'd ever seen. And then freshman year at DePaul, he just really stood out. His talent just jumped off the screen when you watched him play. And then I believe he had some personal issues that he had to deal with. Did he ever make it to the NBA or did he not?
No. And in fact, what he was dealing with was you know, you soft-toeing around it, so I'll just say it.
He was
dealing with some mental issues.
Right.
But he was not diagnosed until, I think I'd been in my 30s out of college and playing in league. He was diagnosed as being schizophrenic.
Right.
And in college back then, you know, that was unheard of. So they didn't know how to deal with it. But he was a good guy. I mean, this joker was smart too. He was valedictorian of his class.
Right.
You know. He was super talented. You know, just got to college, and I think it just got overwhelming because even back then, college was, if you took too much time to think about it, it could take you out of your flow.
Wow. Yes, wow.
You know, and then you got all this competition. You got cats that don't know nobody. They didn't know me. I was a late bloomer.
Right.
I mean, Teddy was, I think, the number one player in the nation when he went to DePaul.
Yeah.
And then, so I was sitting behind him, playing behind him, his roommate, you know. But I remember this, too. The game we played the first time we came to UCLA, Teddy had an awesome game.
Yeah.
And I was having a game. My game was building up. My numbers, I was playing really well in that game. But when I figured out he was playing better, I just went into cheerleader mode for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then at the end of the game, I went and talked to Coach Ray Meyer, and I told him, I said, "I ain't got no problem playing behind nobody." I said, "But I ain't come here to sit on the bench." I said, I'm going to do whatever it takes to be on that floor. I'm going to be on your conscious mind every time you think about it. You know, that was the last game I came off the bench.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't realize you came off the bench. I know Teddy had like I think 28. I got to look that up. He had like a 26, 28 point. I mean, he just had this great game, you know, at UCLA. And so, yeah, so that was some.
No, that Joker was smooth, Marcus. Yeah, I mean, he had a pure form with his shot, you know?
Yeah,
and for him it was natural.
Yeah, but did you get a sense as a youngster, young guy, freshman, roommate, being around him that could you tell that he was headed toward some? I mean, okay, so it was kind of evident at that point.
Well, I, like I said, he was my roommate. I would come in the room, that joke would be sitting up in the corner in the dark. I'd be like, hey,
oh man,
Teddy, what you doing, man? Oh, I'm not doing nothing. I'm just chilling, T.
Yeah.
I said, man, why you got all the lights out?
Right.
I mean,
so he
spent, that was him.
Yeah.
I mean, he was real kind of reclusive and to himself a lot, and but a great guy.
Yeah. No,
great guy.
And thankfully that stigma of mental illness has been softened by a lot of guys.
Yeah. Kevin somebody got to pay the cost for
Kevin
it.
Kevin Love, I mean, somebody, Rosen,
yeah,
speaking out on it, saying, "Hey, look, you know, I need therapy. I got issues. I got to talk to somebody." So there's nothing wrong with that. But
Kevin Love though, Kevin Love had a dad that played in the league, right?
Stan Love.
That's a whole lot.
Yeah, Stan Love. Played at Oregon.
His uncle and his uncle is the Beach
Mike
Boys,
Love.
Right?
Mike Love,
right?
On the Beach
right.
Boys,
right? He is, yeah. So that's a whole lot to climb. That's a whole lot of expectation waiting to happen.
Right, the number one player in the country in high school, Kevin Love, and you know, just had a whole lot of expectations coming out of high school, and as we all did, when you reach this level, I mean, it's pressure. You know, Chris, UCLA, it's an amazing amount of pressure that people don't realize, and some guys are able to process it in a healthy manner. Now, I know you've been a Pentecostal minister since you were 16 years old, I read, but how much did your faith, you know, help it, you kind of get through?
It balanced out everything. And one thing about me is that I never thought too much of myself, but I didn't think too little either.
Right.
You know, I learned real young because I grew up in the streets of Chi. So in the streets, you learn to say less, you know, and listen more. And so it benefited me along with my walk in Christ, you know, because I began to learn things more because I listened and I watched and paid close attention. And then I was a student of the game. You know, my high school coach, Horace Howard, mentored me, and he told me that if I would ever be good at this game or anything in life, I had to become a student of it. And so I literally took it. For everything I've done in my life, my businesses, the ministry, my people skills and stuff, I study because I want to be able to say that I can adapt to pretty much any situation. And most of the situations that have come my way, I've just learned to adapt to them.
Yeah.
You know, be yourself.
Yeah. And speaking of adapting, man, you hit the ground running, came out of DePaul. Did you leave early your junior year?
I left at the end of my junior year.
Okay, left the end. Spent 3 years at DePaul. Rookie year, Chris, TC averages like 24 and almost 11 rebounds a game.
That's crazy.
You came in. 23 and 11.
24 and 11?
24 and 11. Yeah, closer to 24 and 11. Rookie of the year. I had about 7-8 years straight where he averaged over 20, 8, 9, 10 rebounds. I mean, I was surprised you didn't make – you played 2 All-Star games?
Yeah, but who was ahead of you? When I was with San Diego, I guess they figured if we give him Rookie of the Year, we're not letting him get into the All-Star game.
We
lost 50-some games out of 82 that year that I won Rookie of the Year. And then there was James Worthy, Dominique, Clark Kellogg, you know, in that same, you know, conversation. But when I got to Milwaukee, it was all these cats, man. We had you had the Buck Williams, the Charles Barkley,
Larry Bird.
You had a whole bunch of guys, and even though my numbers were equal or better than theirs during that time of season, and we won, I relegated myself to a thought early on in my career, and that is they don't know me.
Yeah.
And because they don't know me, I'm looked at as, you know, oh, that's just TC. But the thing about it is, it's like my first 10 years in the league, I averaged over 28 and 9. I would be comparable to Marcus Johnson, you know, as far as numbers and how somewhat how we played.
Yeah.
No. Because you know, I after I looked back, I thought and I watched your game on tapes and stuff. And this ain't to patronize you, but I thought to myself, all they did was trade one Marcus for another one.
People would ask me about that trade. I'd say, hey, if I was a Bucks, I'd have done the same thing. And that's because even though our games were similar, I'm 6'6", listed as 6'7", 6'6 and a quarter, 220, 225.
You look like blood coming out your mouth when you say
that. But you were 6'9". Now, they had you listed, Terry, 6'9 and 220. But one of your legs looked like it weighed 220, man. I mean,
When I came to Milwaukee, I gained about 30 pounds because I knew the Eastern Conference was more physical.
Okay.
So in Milwaukee, I played at 250, 255.
Okay, see.
At 6'9". But in with the Clippers, it was genuine. I was 220. I just didn't have no body fat. I was like 2-3% body fat.
Right. So, Chris, what I'm saying, when you look at basketball reference or whatever, you see him listed at 6'9", 220. I'm like, that's
yeah.
Because you had Rasheed Wallace, whoever, Chris, saying that Terry Cummings was the strongest man that they ever played against.
And there's no doubt.
Not only was he strong, lower body strength, upper body, but this one of the sweetest jumpers, the handle. I mean, just like I say, if I was the Bucks, I could be mad at him. I would have done the same thing, man.
Hey, TC, no, I was curious.
I'm going to tell you. Go ahead.
Oh, you go ahead. You go ahead, man.
No, I just tell him I hate it happened to you, but I was trying to get out of the Clip organization so bad. I'd have went out and sold fruit on a stand somewhere. Just
I know the feeling, man. I know the. Mm. I thought going to the Clippers, I'm like, look, yeah, we got Norm Nixon, we got James Johnson. You know, we got a budding young superstar in Derek Smith.
We're gonna get
out here and work the Lakers, man. We gonna challenge the Lakers. It's showtime.
Y'all started out 5-0, Dad. MJ. That was the second year. All right.
That first year, I broke my hand the first day of practice.
Oh, yeah.
Derek Smith broke his hand right after me in a stupid drill that Brad Greenberg had us doing. You know, and it just started off wrong. And first time I shot below 50%, yada, yada, yada. But what we're here to talk about, too, is there's a great podcast series, docu-series, called The Bucks Versus the World. And it's talking about the oral history of that 1987 McDonald's Open, man, that you were part of. You were the most valuable player, as a matter of fact, in that. And the world had people like Bob McAdoo and some other really, really great basketball players, the Soviet Union, Sharunas, Marshalonis, and a bunch of guys. T, what do you remember about that experience? Was there an excitement about it? Or was it just kind of like, okay, it's October, it's just another kind of preseason experience? What was your feelings, if you can recall, about that?
I had no barometer for it because, like I said, I was a late bloomer. You know, I only played like 2 years of high school ball.
Wow.
And then by the time I got to DePaul, nobody really knew who I was except for the people in Chi. Yeah. You know, so when we got to that international, I never played international ball. I didn't know. To me, these were just some old hood Nick jokers like me. They were pale skinned.
Really?
Because they were tough, rough and tough, like ballers out in the street. And it turns out in the end that what I remember was the physicality, the rule changes, you know, how you could goaltend and the fact that that game is what is representative of the NBA game right now.
Yeah.
That's the game they played, you know, but were more physical than these guys are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that game definitely had a big impact on you know, just the NBA and the future of the NBA. You were named MVP of that game. When you played against Bob McAdoo that day, right? And he's called you the best power forward of your generation. How was it like going against not only McAdoo, but the big power forwards of that generation, the physicality? What was your mindset like when you would approach those matchups?
Well, Let me ask you a question, Marcus. When you were playing before we got traded, were you playing mostly small forward?
You know, kind of a mixture, but you know, I was a small forward T, but I averaged like, you know, 10 rebounds as a rookie. You know, mm-hmm. back in those days, I didn't like labels. I'm a forward. I rebound. Yeah. I shoot. I can handle. I can dish. I play basketball. I'm a forward.
Yeah.
And then that was right mm-hmm. right at the beginning of the kind of labeling the big and the small and the power yeah. forward, the small forward. So and you play like a you play like a small forward.
I played three, four, and five.
Yeah.
And I thought for me, that yourself, you were a trendsetter. And all I did was I became something of the same. We both are kind of anomalies.
Yeah.
Because what we represented is normal now, where the big guy could handle the ball. He could run like a small forward or a big guard could run point if necessary, you know, play the strongest man on the court, whether he's the power forward or the center, and could brave pretty much anything as the game went on. And my greatest influencer as a coach was Don Nelson, because he didn't let me play just a power forward or a small forward. I had to learn, and you know this about him, because you played for him, right?
Seven years.
So you had to learn everybody's position. He's the only coach I played for that taught that that whole theology.
Yeah.
That you have to know what everybody does from the one to the five, and you have to be able to play their position on offense and defense.
Yeah.
And it forced me to grow up, because with the Clippers, I was just athletic. Yeah. I was playing because I was, you know, I had talent. I worked hard. I outworked everybody that played against me. When I got to Milwaukee, I matured and became a professional and learned how to play the game.
Yeah.
And that was Nelly.
Quick story, Nelly, though, Chris. So we had to take a test and know everybody's position, everybody where mm-hmm. you're supposed to be, defensively, mm-hmm. offensively. And me and Junior Bridgman would always get perfect scores. Ken Benson would struggle. And the big guys would struggle, just knowing what the guard was going to do. So this one year, I didn't get the perfect score, T, Chris. I got like 19 out of 20. And the question I missed, we had this defense, I think it was called Black, where we forced everybody one direction. And so Nelly on the test said, you know, in our Black defense, we force everybody to their left hand. True or false? So I put false. And so Nelly's like, I'm surprised you missed this question. I was like, well, no, Nelly, if we're playing a team with Lowe's Moore and all these left-handers, we wouldn't force them to their left hand. We'd force them to their weak hand, their right hand. They had left hand on the test. And he was like, you're too damn smart for your own good.
and I know he said it just like that. But he didn't change that score either.
You're too damn smart for your own good. So I was like, he was that's instrumental, Terry. He approached me like coming out of college. I was player of the year at UCLA, averaged 22 and almost 12 rebounds. Had a, you know, whatever, Wooden Award winner first time. But he approached me as an NBA player, which is right. Like, I didn't know anything about the NBA game. And he, like an empty vessel, and he filled me up with that NBA knowledge. And that's a different, and you can attest to that. That's a different type of knowledge learning.
Yeah, it made a difference.
Yeah.
Because I never played for another coach with his IQ.
Wow.
On the NBA level. I played for something very close. Larry Brown, to me, is an IQ coach.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but a lot of the coaches, I played for coaches who wanted to make you believe they had that IQ, but they didn't. And once you've seen it, you know what it looks like. It's something that's kind of difficult to put into words, but a great IQ coach is a coach who not only understands the game, but he understands how the personnel fit into the game.
Right.
And he deals with, like you were just saying, he deals with each one or each personnel based upon their ability. Because one of the other things that he did for me was, I wasn't in camp maybe one day, and Nelly came to me, he said, this is what I want you to do. He said, I need you to score and rebound and play defense. And then I started studying and realized I knew I could play defense, but I knew I could play in this system, because you only have to guard a man for about 4 seconds. Because in our defense, you were going to get some help.
Right.
It ain't take me long to figure that out. I said, oh, I could do this.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be out here by myself, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a first for me, too.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of the teams I played on, the Clippers, and sometimes even in DePaul, I felt like sometimes in playing the low post big man at 6'9", 200 pounds then in college, I wasn't going to get no help. Yeah. I had to be strong. I had to use my strength to move the big guy around. Because most of them guys, they didn't want none of that stuff down in the blood. They didn't want to come down there.
No, they didn't. TC, how close with that crew out there in Milwaukee with Moncrief, Pressey, Sigma, you know, Randy Brewer, how close were you guys to breaking through to the finals? You know, getting by the Sixers, Detroit, you know.
A minute, 27 seconds. I lived it. Chris, I lived that. Game 7 in Boston. Ooh. We go from there. I believe we go from there to the championship, or we go to the finals and then to the championship. And we own the Celtics and the Lakers that year. Mm-hmm. And so we're up 7 points, minute 27 to go, and the referee swallowed the whistle.
Oh, wow.
Who were the refs? You remember?
No, I didn't care.
Okay.
Because I put them all after that. I put them all in the same bag. MJ, I told her, in my mind, I said, now if I never knew it before, this thing is truly rigged.
Oh, what year was that? What year was that? What year was that?
Like the my first or second year of our trade.
Okay.
We wound up. It was either the 85 or 86.
Okay. Oh, okay. Wow. So that was Bird, Parrish, McHale, and
yeah, all of them.
DJ, that was the crew.
Yeah. We were giving them the business. We were beating them up in Boston. They would beat us at the Mecca, but we would go back to Boston and whoop them.
Yeah.
And then it came down to if that's how close. I still feel that pain from that, but not to the point it darkens me. But it made me remember that no matter how good you think you are or how prepared you are for something, there are always other elements that you have to take into account so that you don't lose your cool. And you don't forget who you are, you know? Yeah. And you plan on other people's time and you plan on other people's money. So this is about money to them and prestige and brand. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying this to say we lost because of, but I'm going to tell you, I noticed something. It shifted me in my head because it said that no matter how prepared we are, how good we are, we have to play these five guys and these referees.
Wow.
You know?
Fascinating.
Yeah. Chris laughs at me, Terry, when I tell him this story. You know, and you're a singer and a musician and all that, musically gifted. And so I do a lot of writing, poetry and screenplays and all that. We were playing against Bird. And I was dating him up, playing him physical, wouldn't let him touch the ball. So he told Jess Kersey, get him off me, Red. Get him off me. Right now, Terry, Jess Kersey called two fouls on me in about 20 seconds. You know, 30 seconds, whatever. Two possessions, bang, bang. I had to come out the game. So I went home. I went home and wrote a poem called "It's Out of My Hands." No control, no say. Acquiesce to someone's demands. Rule of thumb is act real dumb. Pretend nothing's wrong. Your senses are real. Your mind's intact. It's hard to go along. It's out of my hands. Acquiesce to someone's demand. You play the game. You perform the role. Then you try real hard not to console yourself too long after you're through. Not really a test of a man, but only when the scale is grand you find out who's really who. So I went home and wrote that. Now, Chris, they laughed at me. Chris and who was that? Brandon Jennings. Somebody called me soft.
No, it's. I changed my stance.
You were speaking from your experience and your hurt.
But the point is, it was the same thing you just articulated. You just realized that you're up against it. No matter what
side of my hands. It's out of my hands.
They didn't want a Milwaukee Lakers series. They wanted a Boston Lakers series.
Boston Lakers series.
Because it makes sense if you're a business person and you don't care about the status quo and all that stuff. It makes sense. You know, one of my greatest lessons in the NBA happened in my rookie year. And it was Bill Walton. And I don't know if Richard was there when you got the Richard Hamilton. Because to me, he was the first 7-footer that played out there on that 3-point line and shot. I think it's Richard Hamilton. I know his first name was Richard. He's from the Cali. You could tell he was from the West.
Play with the Clippers Richard, that year? Play with the Clippers?
Yeah. Was it Richard Anderson?
Rich Anderson sounds like, white guy shooter. So
this one I knew these jokers were slow in the league too. You know, they didn't move like we move on the street. You know, like my man you play in the movie. Yeah. They did, yeah. This one I knew they didn't move like us. Him and back then Bill Walton did, he picked when he would play.
Yeah.
He picked his games when he would play and or practice. And so they practicing one day, him and Rich going down at it, and Rich is being physical with him, and Bill is cussing and telling him, I told you, stop it. I'm not playing with you. And then Rich goes down to the other end of the floor. He's standing at the top of the free throw, just yip yapping, running his mouth. Bill says, say one more thing. He said, I'm going to come down there and knock your effing front teeth out. And Bill walks, because Rich is still talking. Bill walks from one end of the court to the other end of the court and hits Richard in the mouth and knocks his two front teeth out on the free throw line.
Wow.
And they asked me, what do you think of that? I said, well, that would never happen to me, because the moment I saw him walking, I'd have been in stance. I'd have been waiting for him to get up on me, you know, because I said, that one thing about me, I know how to defend myself. I know, yes, sir, if we're going to fight, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to precursor it by telling you this ain't going to end the way you think.
Right.
Because you're not going to one punch me and we be done. We're going to fight till I get tired.
Yeah.
So you need to put that and think about it. When you're thinking about fighting me, you're going to need to think about that.
Yeah.
And I got out a whole lot of fights, because really that's my personality.
Right.
You know, people think I'm real soft and calm, and I am calm because I know the other side.
Yes, sir.
But I prefer not to fight. But if we're going to fight, we're going to fight my fight.
Oh, no, you got
don't fight till I get tired.
You got that quiet, crazy thing going on. I knew not the best. I don't know, but you were always cool. It was no issues whatsoever. But, you know, Chris, you know, some guys, you know.
Yeah, some brothers, you know what time it is. You just know what time it is just by looking at him.
Yeah,
he ain't bothering me. I ain't bothering him.
Yeah.
But, you know, let me tell you another story. And this ain't with the Clippers. I was playing for San Antonio, and we were up in Utah playing the Jazz. You know that play they have on the baseline where the three goes across and picks the four to bring Karl Malone over?
Yeah.
Well, I would stand under the rim and wait for the three to come. And when he tried to set a pick on me, I'd literally with one arm move him out the way.
Yeah.
And it was one of the guys from Cali. I can't remember his name, but
Russell,
he was a decent
Brian
player.
Russell.
Russell. Yeah. So he comes to me after he done been hit two or three times. I guess coach giving him the business about not setting the pick, but he can't because I won't let him.
Right. You know?
And so he comes up to me. He said, come as you do that again, I'm going to whoop your so-and-so. I said, you talking to me?
Uh-oh.
I said, you too light in the butt to be trying to talk to me. I walked past his bench. I said, y'all better come get him. I'm going to come get all of y'all. You know, it's just the craziness that you have in that momentary insanity.
Yes, but sir.
And then they be looking at you like, that didn't mean that. Stop playing with him.
Well, Brian is from San Bernardino, so we got to kind of factor that into it, too. He's from San Bernardino.
That ain't what he said. He said.
He's from Pasadena.
He said, I'm from L.A. He said, I'm from L.A. And he started talking Crip and Blood. And I told him, I said, bro, I don't care about none of that. Yeah. I said, I'm from Chicago. Right. I said, we about that.
Yeah.
Different
we about
there.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
Facts.
And then here's another impressive thing, Chris. I think you're with the Bucks, but you sang the national anthem. Right against the Pistons. Did you do it more than once, or was that the only time you did?
Well, just once. Once with Milwaukee, I did it. One time with Seattle too.
So I remember. I think I was in Seattle when you did that. I was working for the Sonics. Me and Kevin Colbert.
Okay.
In the games, that was mid '90s. I think your tail end of your career, but
mm-hmm.
but when you did it against the Pistons, Chris. Not only did he sing the national anthem, so I was kind of curious as to like how you played after that. Because it's different.
Yeah.
It's a different vibe. But he went out and dropped like 29.
Please.
But check this out, though, MJ. Most of that 29 was in the second half, because in the first half, I'd have been standing on the water on the seashore trying to throw that ball. It would not go in. I was so tight.
I was so tight.
I had to get my mind out of singing, performing, and what the guys, because Sydney then was giving me the business on it. Like, boy, you better not mess up.
I hear Sydney right now.
You mess up if you want to.
You better be on key. Don't be off key. Yeah.
And it was acapella, so you know.
That's tough. That's tough.
And that's the toughest song to sing acapella. For most people.
Right. Yeah,
most people who sing it will tell you.
Different range of octaves and all that you got to hit and all.
Yeah,
that.
You don't, unless you gifted, you don't want to start in the mid-high range. You want to start as low as comfortable and build yourself up to it.
Yeah.
But I'm actually getting ready to drop a new project now, my fifth one.
Okay. How did you get involved with that? When'd you realize you had the talent in that direction musically? You know, just talk about your music stuff, man, because it's been really phenomenal.
Well, I started out in music publishing, handling other writers and producers publishing, because they didn't have the legal backbone to go get their money from the publisher. So they would bring their stuff to me. I'd send my people. I'd hire this little Jewish girl named Robin Mures, and she would go out and on her letterhead send that stuff to the labels, and we would take about 5% of whatever came in. That's how I made my first money. But my cousin Percy Beatty, who is an authentic producer. I mean, it's Joker Good, Grammy Award winning. He's the reason that I got as involved as I did. I knew I wanted to be in music, but no one encouraged it in me. And so I had to push myself in that gifting. And I found out I could do it. And then when I found out I could do it, my first monies didn't come because of singing. They came because of music publishing. And they came because I wrote music for BET. I did music for their television shows, intro, outros, theme music, and they paid really well because they didn't want to pay the royalty. They would just give you a fat check. And so, I mean, it wasn't that I needed the money then, but the whole idea they was giving it away like that, I felt it was my responsibility to take what was mine. So in that process of working in the music, I've gotten into doing these different projects, working with different people. And on the music publishing side, we have music publishing for artists like Whitney Houston, the Winans, BBCC Winans, Yolanda Adams, Michael McDonald.
My favorite.
So we've written for a lot of major artists. And I think my business and what I do is much like my game. It's just, it's consistent and it's down low. It ain't, you don't have to, you know, you pat me on the back because I'm doing what I love too. That's the other part of it.
Right.
But the music comes from all of that, and it brings me to where I am.
Now, did you ever collaborate with Gary Garland? I played against Gary Garland when he was at the Paul. He was a couple of years ahead of you. Whitney's brother, they called him the Music Man. He had a nice, sweet game back in college. But did you guys do some things together? Just curious.
No, because the most I got out, me and Gary talked a lot over the years from time to time.
Okay.
But the room I wound up staying in with Teddy Grubbs, my freshman year, was Gary's room.
Okay.
In the dorm. It was a dorm room, so it was music all over the place that he had left, written, so... But no, we never did get a chance to sing or do anything together. But back then, I probably wouldn't have because people were too busy telling me to shut up and be quiet, when it came to that part. I mean, and if you think about it, if you are good at one thing, it is very hard for people to adapt to you being good at more than one thing.
Wow.
100%.
And, why do you think that is? Why do you think that is?
That's a great point. That's a great point.
Why do you think that is?
It ain't just one point, but one of the points is there's a fear that you just might be that much better than them. Because what I've gone ahead of a lot of the people that taught me.
Yeah.
But being who I am, I've always thought my personality is the personality of a sponge. If you teach me, I'll absorb it and I'll come back and I'll teach you. Because I'm going to learn stuff you didn't take the time to learn because you're too busy doing other stuff. But for me, I've always been that student. So with the music, I could always hear music. I could hum it and I'd sing and do all that. But when I found out I wasn't going to get no help for people, I started picking up me some books on scales and chords and, just basic music 101 stuff. Taught myself how to read and write music in the hotel rooms while we were on the road. carried a keyboard and a computer, and the software taught me how to read and know the notes I was playing. And then over time, learning to play taught me to sing better. Yeah. Because I knew the note, I knew what I should be doing with the note, yeah. whether it was a 16th or a triplet or yeah. or whatever. I knew, you know, the same way I was playing it, I could do it. Because yeah. The funny thing about it, and I know it happens with us in every form of life, but you can see stuff in your head through yeah. through your unseen eyes, right. and you can, when you see it, you can do it.
Inner vision.
So like with singing, when
Inner vision, babe. That's good stuff, man.
Yeah, you can hear the riff.
Yeah.
And you can see what the riff looks like on a waveform in your head. And then all you have to do is just go get it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's right there. Just go get it, you know?
I had something random. I was wondering, TC. My dad asked about you collaborating with Garland. I was going to ask about a collaboration if you two had crossed paths when you were in the NBA. Wayman Tisdale, did you guys ever? Okay, so y'all hooked up. Okay.
In fact, I was one of the first people he did hook up with before Wayman started doing stuff. He was playing with Sacramento back then when the Kings were in Sacramento. Is that right? It was Sacramento. Oh, no, Kansas City.
Kansas City,
where they were in Kansas City, and then he came to Sacramento. When they would come through Milwaukee, he would come down. We'd be down in the basement. I was encouraging him, man, look, you need to sing along with playing the bass and stuff, because he was real shy about doing all that stuff. Yeah. But he would tell people all the time, you know, no, I've been sitting around and learning stuff from TC. But he was a sponge kind of dude, too. He picked that stuff up, fooling around with the other Marcus, bass player.
Okay. Miller, Marcus Miller.
Marcus Miller, yeah. So he was really a student of Marcus Miller.
Right.
And I mean, learned a lot of because a lot of his jazz vibes and funk and stuff, ooh, that's Marcus Miller.
Yeah.
That's deep.
That's, talk about talent.
But it speaks to the level of how, as professional athletes, we are able to transition into anything we really want to, because this is another thing I learned, Chris, that the discipline it takes for you to be successful at one thing will work for you at another thing with tweaking, but it'll work the same for you. You can be successful doing something else if it ain't but selling shoestrings.
Yeah.
That same discipline will work.
Yeah, that's good stuff, man. So I'm gonna let you go with this, man, but both you and I nominated for the Basketball Hall of Fame again this year. You were nominated in 2024-2025. What does that mean to you? I mean, just your thoughts on the Hall of Fame and just what it means.
I think it's a great honor even to be mentioned and nominated, because I came to another realization that we are looking to be inducted into the NBA Hall of Fame. But if we pay attention to words, it is no longer the NBA Hall of Fame.
Basketball.
It's the Naismith Hall of Fame. Right.
Right.
And because of that, fewer of us are placed in this place, whether it's the nomination or the induction, because there are so many people from outside that they're looking at on different levels, too. Right. That caused the numbers of NBA players to go down, because I think there's a lot of players like ourselves, and some even maybe more, they deserve it even more because they put in the time. They were the pace setters even for us, but ain't nobody talking about them because most of the people that would have, they not here no more.
Yeah.
And they're not being talked about. But I ultimately, the answer to your question is, I think the nomination is a beautiful thing. It's a great honor. And if I can say this on behalf of both of us, our careers ought to speak for us,
right.
more than anything, because we have done more than enough. And if we don't judge it by anything other than the fact that the people you're putting in before us don't have our numbers, nor our experience, nor have impacted the game the way we have.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So and we don't belong because you owe us a favor, but because we've earned the right to be there.
Yeah. A quick story.
That's what I feel.
after the second time, I've been a finalist three times. Haven't gotten in yet. I'm on the executive committee now to try and get in that way. So we don't know what's going to happen. But TC, after the second time, I didn't get in. It was announced that I didn't get in. Who got in? And so I'm taking my daughter to an AAU game out in Orange County. We pull up to the venue, and then my cell phone lights up, and it says Clyde. And it's Walt Frazier. He didn't get in for a couple of times as a finalist. And so I tell my daughter, you go on in. I got to take this call. I was like, clicked over. What's up, Clyde? He's like, man, F these MFers, man. F them, man. They did the same stuff to me, Marcus. You a Hall of Famer, man. I played against you. I know you're a Hall of Famer. They did the same crap to me. F them. I was like, Clyde, can I quote you on that? Yes, you can quote me on that, man. F the. But the point is that our peers, as we played it, they're like, I know I played against you. I know you're one of the, you're one of the greatest players I've ever seen. At 6'9", yep. 240, 250, 230, whatever it was when we hooked up. Shit. And so, you've got that respect. Rasheed Wallace, Chris Webber talking about your greatness. Bob McAdoo saying you're the best power forward of that era. And I don't even look at you as a power forward because you had game that transcended, kind of roles and the box of being a power forward. But, you deserve to be in, man. I wish you all the best. And you've just got the respect.
Likewise.
Yeah, to respect to your peers, man. So thank you so much. But look, man, we appreciate you stopping by here, District Man, and hope all is going well with the music, this latest project you're about to drop. I'll stay on top of that, and everyone come back and talk about that some more. Anything else, man, please feel free to do so. We
can do that, man. It ain't nothing like traveling down memory lane, man. That's a wonderful thing.
It's a good thing. All right, Terry Cummings, man, we appreciate you.
Y'all take care.
All right, you too.
All right, TC.
All right.
Man, Chris, you just don't know how good this dude was. Terry Cummings, we thank you for stopping by here, District. But, people used to ask me about that trade. And I'd always say, hey, if I was the Bucks, I'd have did the same thing. I mean, this dude, he was a man child, 6'9", 225, 230. And, he came in dropping serious numbers. And we just thank him. And he was a part of that Bucks versus the World, the oral history of the 1987 McDonald's Open, which a lot of people point to as a landmark event in terms of opening the door for everything that we're seeing now in terms of international players.
Yeah, incredible event. Great series. I mean, the characters on that series, the interviews, so engaging. I mean, it's a wonderful listen. And fans can check it out on YouTube, on the official Milwaukee Bucks YouTube channel, on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcast. First episode is out now.
Yeah, and call to action. They can hear us pretty much in the same.
You can hear us. You can hear us in the same spots. Check us out on YouTube at the official Milwaukee Bucks YouTube channel, and then subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcast.
Okay, all right. So listen, man. I wanted to acknowledge a man that not a lot of people are really familiar with. They heard the name, but don't know a whole lot about him. Now, we just celebrated Martin Luther King, his birthday recently, mid-January. The Bucks played down in Atlanta on Martin Luther King Day and all that good stuff. And there was another Black American who I wanted to acknowledge, Chris. And this is a guy by the name of Paul Robeson. Now, everybody's kind of heard that name, but don't really know exactly what he had to go through. And I think about it, Chris, because he passed away January 23rd, 1976. I was a junior at UCLA. And Richard Washington, my teammate, All-American Richard Washington, we went to Billy Packer, Dick Enberg, Billy Packer. We're doing a Notre Dame-UCLA game. The day after, Paul Robeson had passed away, and we had asked Billy Packer jointly, Richard and I, to acknowledge that Paul Robeson had passed away and the greatness of Paul Robeson. So this is around the 50th anniversary of when he passed away. But he was a two-time Walter Camp All-American at Rutgers, just one of a couple of Black students there at the time in the 1920s, 21, 22. Walter Camp All-American, he was Phi Beta Kappa. He was valedictorian, Chris. He went on to Columbia Law School, became a lawyer, practiced law in New York, had a secretary, white secretary at this big prestigious law firm in New York City who would not take dictation because he's a Black man. So he quit law, would not take dictation. He wanted to dictate her to dictate a letter to her. She's like, no, I'm your secretary, but I'm not. No, I'm not doing that.
She wouldn't take dictation. That's crazy.
She wouldn't take dictation. So he left the law profession because of the racism involved. Yeah. And what did he do? He became an actor. Was in Othello, played Othello, and went to London.
He's the guy with the deep voice. He's the guy with the baritone. So MJ, not to cut you off, but the reason I know about Paul Robeson is because I happened to go down a rabbit hole one night on YouTube, and I stumbled on his testimony. He testified in front of Congress, or he did something, but that's like was my first introduction to this dude. And then I did some research and found out who he was, but I was like blown away by his testimony, the eloquence, the stateliness, the command of the room. Like, this is one of the dopest dudes I'd ever seen in a court setting, you know, to be an African-American back then talking like he was talking. I was like, wow. I was like,
And what happened, so he spent a lot of time overseas. He lived in London for a while. He was on stage in London, and Eugene O'Neill wrote a part for him especially. He was in a musical Showboat. He played this character, Joe, in Showboat and got critical reviews. He played Emperor Jones over in London. And so then he went to the Soviet Union in 1934, and he felt like this was the first time in his life that he really felt a lack of racism, that people just, as Martin Luther King talked about, the content of his character instead of the color of his skin. And he fell in love with the Soviet Union. So when he got back to the United States, all of a sudden now the House
communist
activities, you know, they're looking at communists. They're looking for communists under every bed, the Red Scare. And so many great writers and actors in the 50s got caught up in that and had to write in pseudonyms and all that kind of stuff. But check this out, Chris. In the midst of all that, he was blackballed. You know, he was literally a red ball, if you want to put it that way. But he had his passport taken away. In the 1940s, he was making $100,000 a year. The very next year, that dwindled down to $3,000 a year for that year, because they all of his speaking engagements, concerts, all that stuff. He sang spirituals, and he was the hottest, most popular black figure, kind of the Muhammad Ali of the day, most prominent black figure in the world at that point in time. And because of his political views, now he never acknowledged being a member of the Communist Party, never officially joined, but just that association. And he wound up finally getting his passport back in, I think, 1958. Supreme Court made a decision, traveled a little bit more. But by that time, Chris, he'd had a nervous breakdown, early 60s, and was treated for, you know, exhaustion and mental issues and all that. It was just never the same. So just want to acknowledge, you know, a great black American passed away about 50 years ago and what he has done. And so now we segue that into collegiate sport and this NIL situation. These guys are getting paid and it's like the paradigm has shifted. I want your opinion on this because you keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening. Do you think that there's been a drastic change in the way college coaches, I mean, the old Bobby Knight, the old tough love, coach them up, cuss them out, talk about their mamas, talk about everything, you know, call them all out of their name. Do you think there's still a place for that type of coaching in today's landscape of college basketball?
Well, that's a great question, MJ. And yes, I do think there's a place, and my reasoning, it might surprise you. I think it's a place because I do truly feel like at the core of every athlete, every great player is a player that wants to be coached up. There's a player in there that wants to be told things straight up, treated, you know, like everyone else, you know, earn his keep, etc. So, like, I feel like that. And with guys getting paid now, I feel like coaches have more of a license to be a Bobby Knight, to cuss you out, to talk to you crazy. You have more of a license because now you're a professional, a pseudo professional, whatever your employee status is by the NCAA, doesn't really matter, but you're getting paid to play. So if you don't perform, you got to be held to a certain standard, because as a coach, we both could be out of here if you don't play well. So I'm going to put as much pressure on you to get the most out of you every single day, especially now that you're making $1 million or $2 million like Donovan Dent is at UCLA. And we see it with Mick Cronin. I use Mick Cronin at UCLA as my example. because I'm really close to the program. Obviously, the success, the winning hasn't been at the level that you might have wanted it this year. And the response from the players has been sort of iffy, but they just beat Purdue, the number four ranked team in the country, 2 days ago without their top 3-point shooter and top defender. And for everybody that's been talking about Mick Cronin is sort of this abrasive, rough around the edges, his style won't last in today's game. Well, guys are starting to buy in. It's midseason. It's a little later than you want it, but the reality remains the same. Danny Hurley out at UConn, he's known for histrionics. He's known for wearing his emotions on his sleeve. He's known for going off of his guys. Tom Izzo just told a guy in his huddle that he told a player yesterday, 2 days ago, you can't guard my mother. You couldn't guard my mother. Izzo. So Tom to the Izzo is still talking like that. And then you have other hard asses from Brad Underwood of Illinois to you know, Nate Oates at Alabama. So I think, MJ, to answer your question, there still is a role. There still is a place for these guys. But you got to win if you're going to be that type of coach.
So Bobby Hurley, who I love down at Arizona State, he's talking about how this team is just not hearing his voice anymore. He's not questioning their commitment and all that, but they have lost 7 of 8 after a great start. You have this coach at Air Force, Joe Scott. He's been suspended because of his treatment of the cadet student athletes, the cadet athletes, as they called them. But you look at his numbers, Chris, last year they were 4-28, 5 straight losing seasons, 3-14 at the time of this recording. So you can imagine, he's frustrated and he's taking it out on the players. But my point, bigger point, is that these guys are 18. 18, if you commit a crime or whatever, you try it as an adult. You're old enough to join the army and go and die for your country. Aren't you old? Just a modicum of respect because of being an adult, despite the fact that you're making all this money. I mean, it just seems like there's a little bit of a shift.
Great point.
I mean, Tony Bennett, he quit Virginia because he just didn't want to deal with, and I don't know the full context of what he didn't want to deal with, but I suspect, you know, you've got to kind of change your approach a bit, and some coaches can do it, some can't. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, no, you make some really good points about things about meeting players halfway. And I'll use Mick Cronin as an example. Typically, you know, he's Mr. Defense, and his emphasis is always on that one side of the ball. You know, wasn't practicing a ton of offense. But this season in particular, he changed his philosophy, and they were practicing offense a lot. And they were, you know, UCLA for a number of games was one of the top, 30 offensive rated teams in the country, which was unique for a Mick Cronin team. We hadn't seen that in a while. But my point is, that was his way of meeting people halfway. He's not as abrasive in the media, though some would probably disagree with me. He still throws guys under the bus, but not to the level which we've seen him do it before, and which I think he could with this team. So, no, I agree. You got to meet these kids halfway, show them the respect of an adult, but also you have to also come down on them on performance-based issues. So the days of having a scholarship and playing bad and not, getting an earful from your head coach, or maybe you did, but I just knew when I was at UCLA with Coach Herrick, bad games and stuff, they were real judicious with criticism. So it was it wasn't like, all right, you suck. And it was a real delicate way in which they handled things. So last point on that, I think the longevity. So the coaches that are going to stick around and last in this current scope, in this current era, MJ, are going to be the coaches that can get more like what you're saying, meet them halfway so that their voices don't get drowned out and dudes and guys and girls don't tune them out.
Yeah, and moving to that transfer portal, I think they made some adjustments to that. But anyway, just an observation. And speaking of observation, let's talk about the topic that we're here for. Let's talk about these Milwaukee Bucks. And, man, they've had a spate, I love that word, spate of just underwhelming performances. Now, I remember, Chris, going into the end of December, there was the Bulls and the Hornets and the Wizards, and there was a lot of talk about how this was a great time to make some hay and improve on that sub 500 record. Then they wound up losing to the Wizards and struggling to get some other teams on the road. They did beat the Lakers, which was really good. Lost to Denver without Jokic, without Jamal Murray, Peyton Watson, our guy from UCLA, lit him up in that game. But where the Bucks are now, I mean, with all the banter that's going on, so as of this recording, they lose to who they lose to most recently? They help me out here. We lost to OKC. OKC, and this is OKC team without Alex Caruso, Isaiah Hartenstein, Aaron Wiggins, who's been playing great, without Jalen Williams. Jalen Williams, both of them.
They were undefeated. They were undefeated without Jalen Williams. So
I'm just saying that it wasn't like, you know, the Bucks were without Miles Turner, without Kevin Porter Jr. But I'm saying that OKC was missing some pieces also. But it's sure. Just Bucks got outscored by 20 in the first quarter, 8 turnovers in the first quarter. OKC leads the league in turnover points and all that good stuff. They're fine. They're a well-oiled machine. Mark Dagnall, I thought was I had no idea who he was. I didn't know why Sam Presti would turn the keys over to him. But now, after a few seasons, you understand exactly what he's got going on. But my point is that the Bucks. Let's get back to the Bucks. Now you've got some a team in disarray just a bit. The energy, the effort, just God. I mean, they're having a hard time summoning it. And I just want to get your opinion on Giannis's comments and some of the things he said after that OKC game in particular.
Yeah, it's hard. It's disheartening. It's getting increasingly more difficult to frame things around the Bucks in a positive fashion. I mean, we definitely try here at District to keep the glass half full type of approach. But when you see the lack of effort and you see a team that's seemingly drowning out the voices of the coaching staff, where the coaches are no longer able to get them to play a certain style, a certain brand, and with a certain level of intensity and effort. I mean, you got an issue. And then when your star player, who has been at the center of everything, of the noise this season, is in the post-game press conference, says the team, just really has a long list of complaints about gameplay for the Bucks and what guys aren't doing, and guys are selfish, and nobody's passing me the ball, and I'm not getting enough shots, and our guy Eric Name is writing a long profile piece on why Giannis is getting less shots, stuff like that. So now they're in a bad spot. I don't know what it looks like in terms of what the light at the end of the tunnel is, but I know that the current iteration of the Bucks, given everything that's going on with the drama going on in that locker room and the product they're putting on the floor, ownership can't be happy. So I don't know. It's like, if something's got to give. We're at a point where what they used to say, MJ, the rubber meets the road or whatever that statement is. And I feel like that's where the Bucks are right now.
Burning rubber on that road right now. But just wanted to toss that out there, man. And still enough season to turn things around, but just kind of, how much of a change is necessary to get this energy kind of headed back in a positive direction. I guess we shall see. So we'll find out next week on Here District. So Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, we're out of here, Here District.